And then I'm going to go talk to him a little bit. I just want to have a talk with him.
You made it. All right. All right, welcome. We're going to get started right away because we've got a lot of material to go through public testimony, and also the staff is going to do a very, very brief walkthrough, and then they are going to have to start working on amendments, so we're going to do that. We have a list of public testifiers. If you would like to testify, just sign up with Paige, and if you're not on the list, and we will get you on the list. So with that, Mr. Berg, are you ready to walk through the initial sections?
Yes. Mr. Chairman, members, members should have had passed out a about 12-page letter-sized document, the cover of which says at the top, 2017 House HHS Finance Items, HF 2467DE1. This is the summary sheet. The following pages are the change item detail for people to see, but I'm just going to go briefly down the change item sheet. And looking at the first shaded column, which is 16 and 17, you'll see starting from the top on line 2 that the DE amendment funds the HF 3615 RERIC, which is the MA estate lien relief provisions. Going to line 5 and 6 is the HF 2614 ZERWAS dental provisions, and just the rate portion of that bill. Line 9 is the long-term care simulation model that Representative Anderson carried, HF 3350. Line 10 is Representative Thies's bill on the in-home IT assessments, 3287. Line 11 has Representative Backer's bill on border nursing facilities rates that does not show a cost because it does not go into effect until fiscal 20. On line 12 is Representative Schumacher's nursing facility moratorium exception bill, House File 3039. Going down to line 15 is Representative Franson's House File 3433 on child care, which has a $526,000 cost. Line 16 is HF 2470, Representative Knobloch's Border County child care rate, which pays the highest rate for child cares that are on the border of two counties. It's got $54,000 in costs in 16-17 and higher costs in the tails. Going down to the other bills line, you have Representative Mack's certified emergency medical tech bill, which costs $1,000 in 16-17 and $8 in the tails. Representative Baker's IMD bill, 3026, which has a cost of $57.93, $5,793,000 in 16-17 and no tails. That's a one-time appropriation. Representative Norton's Child Support Task Force, HF 2740, is $149,000 cost in the current biennium. And Representative Norton's House File 2889, also on child care, the prior one was $85,000 and has tails of $84,000, and the 2889 has a one-time cost of $149,000. On line 24 is HF 2609, Representative Keel's bill on community behavioral health clinics, which costs $188,000 in the current biennium and $8.4 million in the tails. On lines 25 and 26 is Representative Dean's bill, House File 3248, that is repurposing some of last year's County Children's Services grant money on a one-time basis to fund the White Earth administrative costs, or rather child protection item. And then going down to line 20, I see there are actually three line 26s on here. The second line 26 is HF 3249, also Representative Dean's bill on White Earth that appropriates the administrative cost to them in the current biennium on a one-time basis for $1.4 million. And on line the last line, 26, HF 2405, Representative Zerwas's waiver bill that we heard last night, which has a $213,000 appropriation in the current biennium. At the Department of Health, on line 29, Representative Dean's bill 2140 that we heard last night has a one-time appropriation of $250,000. Representative Whalen's bill on HF 3150 on apportioned data reporting has a one-time cost of $71,000. There are three non-general fund items. Representative Dean's House File 2628 that appropriates $1 million per year for the Greater Minnesota Family Residency Program from the Healthcare Access Fund. And then two state government special revenue fund items. We heard Representative Zerwas's Children's Hospice program and Representative Sanders' Radon Act changes. Those are, as I say, in the state government special revenue fund. On line 35, we are rescinding the funding from last year's bill to the Commerce Department for a waiver that they did not spend the money on, although the language remains. And then you will see the mechanism on the funding. On line 39, that's a total on line 38 of $10.6 million in 16-17 and $14.8 million in the tails from the general fund. And line 39 reduces general fund appropriations to the Department of Human Services that are being used for MnSure IT and operations purposes for the same amount, so that the amendment has a net general fund cost of zero in 16-17 and zero in 18-19, and going down to lines 42 and 43, the healthcare access fund expenditure of $1.2 million in 16-17 and $2.02 million in 18-19 is also offset by a reduction in the healthcare access fund money to DHS for MnSure IT and operations, leaving a net healthcare access fund expenditure of zero in 16-17 and zero in 18-19. And on the final line, finance line on line 46 shows the state government special revenue fund item costs for the two items I mentioned. And Mr. Chair, there's a list of other items below that have language in the bill that do not have costs. And that's the summary, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Berg. All right. Next up, if we could go to continuing care with Ms. Pinelli, and then if the researchers could just follow along and just kind of pick up one right after the next. We won't just go back and forth, and you can fill in as you like, starting out with Article 1 and going through 6. Ms. Pinelli.
Mr. Chair and members, Article 1 is the continuing care article. Sections 1 and 7 of Article 1 are related to notice to MA applicants of potential estate recovery. Sections 2, 3, 11, and 12 are related to modification of a nursing facility consolidation project in Red Wing, and moving the consolidation rate adjustment from the property rate to the external fixed rate. Sections 4 and 5.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Liebling.
Mr. Chair, Ms. Pugnelli, what are we looking at? I mean, is there something we should be following along with here?
Mr. Chair and Representative Liebling, I was just walking through the sections of Article 1.
So we should just be looking at the bill itself? Okay, thank you. Sorry, Mr. Chair.
Ms. Pugnelli.
Mr. Chair, Sections 4 and 5 provide some clarifying language to nursing home moratorium exception funding language, and then Section 6 is the new nursing home moratorium exception funding for fiscal year 2017. Section 8 relates to spousal anti-impoverishment. Sections 9, 10, and 14 relate to MA forgiveness for adults without children. And then Section 13 is a modification of nursing facility rate adjustment for border cities, adding in Moorhead.
And, Mr. Chair, Article 2 is the health care article, and that starts on page 14 of the bill. Section 1 provides MA coverage for services provided by a community emergency medical technician. Section 2 increases rural dental payment rates. And Section 3 increases payments for durable medical equipment, prosthetics, orthotics, or supplies to put into effect an increase that was passed the last year. And then moving to Article 3, which is the MinSure article, Section 1 requires the Commissioner of Commerce to obtain legislative approval through the enactment of a new law for making interagency transfers or within agency transfers of more than $100,000 a year. And I should also note that Section 6 applies the same requirement to the MinSure Board. Section 9 applies the same requirement to the Commissioner of Health. And Section 10 applies the same requirement to the Commissioner of Human Services.
Mr. Chair and members, Section 2 of Article 3 subjects the Minnesota Eligibility System Executive Steering Committee to the open meeting law. Section 3 removes the Commissioner of Human Services from membership on the MinSure Board. And Sections 4 and 5 are conforming changes to that change. Section 7 establishes the Executive Steering Committee to govern the Minnesota Eligibility System. Section 8 requires the Legislative Oversight Committee to review quarterly reports submitted by the Steering Committee.
And, Mr. Chair, we can now move to Section 11. This requires the Commissioner of Human Services to apply for a waiver to allow persons eligible for Minnesota Care to decline Minnesota Care coverage and obtain tax credits and cost-sharing reductions through purchasing a qualified health plan.
Section 12 directs the Commissioner of Human Services to seek a federal waiver to establish a federal state eligibility determination and enrollment system. And under this system, the Commissioner of Human Services would conduct enrollment and eligibility determinations for medical assistance in Minnesota Care, and qualified health plan enrollment and eligibility determinations would be performed by the federally facilitated marketplace. And Section 13 is the repealer. It repeals the rules and statutes that govern MinSure, and the repealer is contingent on receipt of the waiver in Section 12. Moving on to Article 4, this is the Health Department article. The first several sections deal with changes to the radon testing and mitigation statute. Section 1 classifies radon testing and mitigation data in the Data Practices Act. Section 2 clarifies rulemaking authority of the commissioner related to radon rules. Section 3 moves the date by which radon mitigation systems have to have a systems tag from October 1, 2017 to January 1 of 2018. Section 4 modifies the services for which radon licensure is required. Section 5 establishes some additional exemptions from radon licensure. Section 6 modifies the licensing fees related to radon. Section 7 specifies that the state laws on radon licensure do not preclude local units of government from requiring additional permits or inspections. That's, I think, the end of the radon stuff. Section 8 requires the Commissioner of Health to establish a website for pharmacies to voluntarily list prescription drug prices, and consumers would be able to search this website for prices and available discounts. Section 9 establishes an additional exclusion from home care licensure. Sections 10 through 14 make modifications to the hospice licensure statutes. to expand the definition of hospice patient to include individuals who are age 21 or younger and have been diagnosed with a life-threatening illness that contributes to a shortened life expectancy. Section 15 modifies abortion reporting requirements to require reporting of the facility code for the patient and the physician if the abortion was performed via telemedicine. Sections 16, 17, and 18 make modifications to safe harbor provisions. 16 gives additional authority to the Director of Child Sex Trafficking Prevention to manage an additional grant funds. Section 17 expands eligibility to youth age 24 and younger. Section 18 establishes a grant program for screening and treatment for pre- and postpartum mood and anxiety disorders. Sections 19 and 20 modify requirements related to preparation in embalming rooms in funeral establishments. Section 21 is another change related to safe harbor. It transfers management of some grant funds from the Commissioner of Public Safety to the Commissioner of Health. Section 22 modifies an effective date related to radon licensing. And Section 23 is a repealer related to prep and embalming rooms.
Mr. Chair and members, starting on page 41 is Article 5, Chemical and Mental Health. The first two sections in that article are on the certified community behavioral health clinics, instructing the commissioner to develop certification requirements for those clinics. Sections 3 to 6 are related to the institutions for mental diseases and the reduction in the county rate for placements. Section 7, the final section in that article, is a pilot project for treatment of postpartum and prenatal for postpartum and prenatal women who have substance use disorders. Article 6 is the Children and Families article that begins on page 46. Section 1 modifies child care assistance rates for cities located in more than one county. Sections 2 to 4, 12, and 13 are the provisions from the Select Committee on Affordable Child Care dealing with electronic applications, notification of licensing violations, training for the licensors, and the legislative task force. Sections 6 through 11 are the package from the Child Support Working Group that deal with the parenting expense adjustment for purposes of determining child support obligations and establishing the Child Support Task Force. And Section 5 is the Food Stamp and Employment Training Program provision.
All right. I think we're going to go to just real quickly. If once again, if folks are here for public testimony and you would like to testify, we're going to keep public testimony to about 2 minutes a person, which is kind of our customary track. We have had about 23 sign up so far. So I think we could probably complete public testimony by 2:30. If we don't, we certainly have the room and we can come back. But what I would like to do is to open it up for public testimony so that we can do that, so that people who particularly who have traveled here can have an opportunity to do that as soon as possible. And then we'll have member discussion tomorrow for the bill. First up, we have Marsha Vandenberg, and Bruce Nelson is on deck. And Rick Rayburn warming up.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Committee. My name is Marcia Vandenberg, and I am here on behalf of the foster children. I was very sad to see that you have not included any money for foster care. As you know, under the North Star Care for the Child, you cut the rates last year dramatically, and so now a 12-year-old gets $22.03 a day, and that's it's not sufficient, and our homes are closing faster than I can come here. I was here last week, and in that period of time, two more homes who do therapeutic care in Anoka County have given their, they've said they're done. They're done. They're not going to be able to financially take care of kids anymore. One of the homes, they actually have sold their house. That way nobody can come and say, please take more kids. Yesterday I was asked to take a child, and I was considering taking that child when I found out that that child would be having an hour and a half bus ride. I live 12 miles north of the city of Anoka, and that child will be going to school in Jordan. There is no one to take care of the children, and that's what I continue to tell you, and it is because of the cut in the North Star rate. That $18.58 for 0 to 5-year-olds a year ago was $21.69. We need that rate increased. I applaud you for asking a pilot project for prenatal and postnatal care. I mean, that's a wonderful thing, and that's good, and I know it's federal money, but we have to find some money to take care of these kids, because those kids live in my home. I've adopted 6 of them. They need your consideration. Yesterday I spoke to a parent who's had a child in her home. He's 10. He's been there for 4 months. No MAPSI. No additional money in the home. So it's $22.03 a day. Thank you for allowing me to speak to you. I appreciate your time. Please, I implore you to find money for foster care, because there's not going to be anybody left to take care of the kids.
Thank you for your testimony, Ms. Vandenberg. Mr. Nelson, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I am Bruce Nelson with ARM. We're an association of providers that support people with disabilities across the state of Minnesota. Mr. Chair, I have 4 thank yous. Number one, assuming that you incorporate Representative Drastowski's bill that was heard yesterday into the omnibus bill, I want to thank you for a mechanism that provides a rate and wage increase for caregivers their service providers across the state, and I trust as this bill progresses in the conference committee, we'll be able to work on it even more to find something that's sustainable to help us retain and recruit caregivers. Also, in the bill posted yesterday, or a couple days ago, 3 things were not included that were in the governor's budget, and I want to thank you for not including them. One was $4.8 million a year in annual increase in fees to providers. This comes at a time when we're, would have come at a time when we're scrambling to find people, to take care of people. And this would be another unfunded mandate and would have diluted from our efforts to do that. I want to thank you for not including another mandate that would have funded a study maybe had good purposes. It was very vaguely defined in the governor's bill, and you did not include that, so thank you. And the other, finally, not including a provision that would have allowed the commissioner to take a bed from one group home in one part of the state and give it to another provider in another part of the state. Very destabilizing thing, the way the bill was crafted, and I thank you very much for not including that. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Nelson. Thanks for being here today. Next up, we have Mr. Rick Rayburn and Scott Kilrood on desk. Welcome back to the committee, Mr. Rayburn.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and the committee. I'm definitely supporting the bill 3467, especially regarding the estate lien issue. Because of previous testimonies and the growing statewide awareness of estate liens, I'd like to quickly stress the absolute necessity of removing the 55 and older clause from Minnesota's books. If this clause is not rescinded, multitudes will be faced with no affordable means of health care coverage or no coverage and then the federal fine. The state should not single out this age and economic group for what amounts to a form of, to put mildly, coercion. The 55 and older clause is a barrier to affordable health care for these people. This is not equal protection under the law. This is exactly why the 14th Amendment was written into the Constitution, to protect a certain group of people from being denied that which all other groups are privileged. The 14th Amendment has liberated many such groups in the past. The 55 and older clause violates one of the principles upon which our country and our government is founded. So let's do away with this outdated discriminatory policy. Let's work together to make Minnesota a better place. This is a new millennia. It's time for the 55 clause to go. Mr. Chair and the committee, from many, many in greater Minnesota and myself, I thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Rayburn, and I do appreciate the fact that you traveled great distance several times for your testimony, so I do appreciate that, and thanks for coming back again.
And thank you for listening.
Mr. Scott Kilrood?
Mr. Chair, I'm replacing Scott today. He can't make it. My name is Claudia Fussard.
Yep. Welcome back, Ms. Fussard.
Thank you. And I would just like to point out here 25.18, the federal waiver, which is, where is the MA waiver to buy up? Where is our choice, my choice? This is to the federal waiver for Minnesota Care. We want to know about the waiver for MA to buy up and out of that.
Okay, I understand, Ms.
Okay, it's in your bill right here.
Yeah, understand.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
All right.
Thank you. Thank you, committee.
Thank you, Ms. Fussard, for coming back. Next up, we have Sue Abderholden from NAMI. Welcome to the committee, Ms. Abderholden.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members. Sue Abderholden, Executive Director of NAMI Minnesota, and I thank you for the opportunity to testify in the Omnibus Health and Human Services bill. NAMI Minnesota greatly appreciates the inclusion of language and funding for the certified community behavioral health clinics. Providing services through a one-stop shop will make accessing mental health services the type and intensity needed much easier. We also appreciate the language that would enable Minnesota to apply for a grant to support women with pre- and postpartum mood and anxiety disorders. There are several items in the governor's budget that were not included that I do want to mention. As you know, we have a severe flow problem in our mental health system with people backed up in our ERs, community hospitals, and Anoka, and the solution is complex. There isn't just one thing you can do to fix it. There were several things in the governor's budget that would have helped, including staffing for the full 16 beds at the community behavioral health hospitals, funding the Transition to Community Initiative program to move over half of the people who are at Anoka right now who don't need to be there into the community, creating a community competency restoration program, expanding the state's competency restoration unit, and expanding the use of the crisis housing fund so that people can hang on to their homes when hospitalized. This last one actually doesn't cost any money, and I have an amendment that could put that language back in the bill. I do want to talk, though, about the staffing at AMRTC and the Security Hospital. There was a lot of money in the governor's budget for these two facilities and for state-operated programs. NAMI has been concerned about accountability and transparency in terms of the budgets, not only for those two programs, but all state-operated services. But we also know that when supervisory and quality assurance staff at Anoka were let go, the quality did go down. You don't have seasoned nurses actually training in the younger ones. And this resulted in identical treatment plans and other issues as cited by licensing authorities, and also longer lengths of stay. At the Security Hospital, we have long heard complaints from patients and family members about the lack of treatment due to the lack of mental health professionals, which certainly doesn't help people in their recovery and may be why we see the average length of stay being 6 to 8 years. People are civilly committed to both of these facilities. Their liberty, their freedom has been taken away, including their ability to choose their own treatment providers. And thus, the state has the responsibility to provide a minimum adequate treatment in the therapeutic environment. They are patients at these institutions who live with a serious mental illness through no fault of their own. As a state, we have a responsibility to provide adequate care and treatment. Hold the department accountable, require transparency, but ensure that treatment is provided. Again, thank you for the opportunity to testify. And in one final note, let me say that NAMI greatly appreciates that funding for the school-linked mental health program appeared in the education bill.
Thank you, Ms. Abderholden. We do appreciate it. Next up, we have Nikki DeLavencio.
Thank you.
Welcome to the committee.
Thank you. Thank you, Chair. Thank you, members. I'm Nikki DeLavencio, and I'm here to talk to you about my experiences with home care and overtime. I am an ally of SEIU Healthcare Minnesota. My PCA is a member, And on behalf of SEIU, we are disappointed that the House HHS bill does not contain money to pay for home care overtime. The governor's supplemental budget does contain $18 million to comply with the new Department of Labor overtime regulations. We understand that this committee is working with a very restrictive target, but we hope that in this money will be included in the future compromise. The original Federal Fair Labor Standards Act required workers to be paid overtime after 40 hours of work in a week. That bill, however, did not include domestic workers, including what we now call home care workers and PCAs. Recently, the Obama administration changed federal rules so that home care workers would now be included in the federal overtime law. The new rules have survived court challenge, are now in effect, and Minnesota must comply. Without new money to pay for overtime, providers and consumers will be forced to choose between cutting service hours, cutting base pay, or capping workers at 40 hours a week. 40-hour caps have been the most common reaction throughout the industry due to the lack of resources to pay for time and a half. Blanket caps too often lead to workers not getting paid or clients not getting services. For example, in my own life, I receive 10 hours of care every day. My partner also receives 10 hours of care every day. Together, we have a 4-year-old daughter and quite the busy life. Most of the home care workers I have work 40 hours per week. The help with all my daily activities in life, like showering, food preparation, laundry, appointments, work, and every aspect of life. As most of you know, going to the bathroom and being sick are not things that you can always schedule. So when these things happen, my home care workers either do it for free or it doesn't get done. Even with a regular schedule, when you qualify for more than 40 hours of service, your worker is capped at 40 hours. It is almost impossible to find another worker to pick up just a few hours a week. I am forced to decide between asking my current worker to work off the clock or going without service. If Minnesota does not provide additional funds to comply with the overtime law, it will be unfair to workers and unfair to clients such as myself. I hope you find a way to reach an agreement with the governor. Thank you for allowing me to testify.
Thank you, Ms. Villavencio. We do appreciate it. Next up, we have Lori Olson and Tim Headley and Mike Moriarty are on deck. Welcome to the committee.
Mr. Chair and committee members, we're changing up the order a little bit, but we're all speaking on behalf as a group today. My name is Amy Long, and I work at the Minnesota Security Hospital in St. Peter. So you know my background. I hold a master's degree in healthcare administration, and I've been at the security hospital for a little over a year. Thank you for allowing us to be here today as a group. We are here to discuss the governor's proposal developed out of the Bureau of Mediation Services collaborative process to improve safety and care provided at the security hospital. I understand that none of this has been included in the bill. I plead for you to reconsider this proposal and give it the merit and attention it deserves, and to realize how approval of this proposal will impact the patients, staff, and other stakeholders of the services we provide. What I would like to point out, we have been grossly underfunded for years, and as a result, we have unsafe environments and inadequate staffing levels. Because of our significant lack of resources, we have endured OSHA safety violations, unconditional licensure, and sadly, injuries to staff and patients. Management and labor partners have devotedly and tirelessly been doing all we can to meet the needs of our patients, the training and safety needs of our staff members, and simple basic upkeep of campus facilities. Direct care and treatment in the security hospital have many, many dedicated and smart employees that you will be hearing from today. We have done the research and we are falling behind other similar state institutions. For example, other state mental health forensic institutions have a staffing ratio of 3.3 staff to every one patient. We have two staff for every one patient. We ask for you to hear us out and adequately fund us in order to increase staffing for all disciplines, security, clinicians, nursing, support services, facilities, and maintenance. Decrease the high rate of turnover and burnout that our staff are feeling, and provide much-needed ongoing training for our staff members. I am a state of Minnesota employee who goes to work every day wanting to make a difference, and it is discouraging to watch even the most dedicated of staff burn out when asked to do the work of two or three people. And it is sad to watch patient progression slow due to the inability to provide robust clinical services. So frankly, I think it is up to you to help us make that difference and give us the funding that we need. Thank you.
Thank you. Please proceed in whatever order you like. Introduce yourself for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Hello, Mr. Chair. I'm Tim Headley, committee. I'm Tim Headley with Minnesota Security Hospital, Security Council Lead. I'm also the local 404 AskMe president there on campus. If not already familiar with our story, I can revisit that. I was hoping not to, but we're very concerned that items from the governor's proposal are not included today on all levels of DCT. Again, back to September 2014, when we raised our concerns, we watched our injury rates continuously rise from there. If you want me to get articulated on some of what those injuries look like, I can do that. Even today, we have people being stabbed in the face. Injured knee, arm, elbow, you can name it. Again, there's still an existing fear that there could be another murder around the corner. We need this. Again, I can't express this enough. I don't know where to even begin. We look to those who are supposed to support us in moving forward in our future, and we're here years later. I'm sharing the same stories, if not new stories. This is concerning to us. But now today, I can tell you that I can share LPN stories of burnout, massive overtime. I can share stories of a physical plant that can't keep up with the old infrastructure that we have and trying to keep repairs and keeping it adequate. It's concerning. We don't know where else to look. We can only look up, and we rely on you for that support. And we, again, hope that you reconsider everything within our governor's proposal and that you support that, because, again, I'm hoping not to return with higher injury numbers. I'm hoping to return without a story of a murder. I'm hoping not to return with stories of people who are permanently injured and can no longer be employed, with not in our state but with anywhere else, because of their disabilities. We need help. So if you'd like me to share these stories in more detail to get you that story, I can do that for you afterward, but I don't think it should be necessary. I think this is something that when we ask, and if we have this number that we provided you today, last year, the year before, that this isn't something I should have to come up here and redundantly repeat on the behalf of those who are working for our state. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Headley. Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself for the record and proceed.
Mr. Chair and committee, my name is Lori Olson. I'm a registered nurse at Minnesota Security Hospital. I have been employed by the state for about 18 years. I am here to talk to you about staff and patient safety. Currently on our units at Minnesota Security Hospital, we are severely short-staffed. When I come to work in the morning, it is likely because of staff shortage that I will be working the second shift. Some of our RNs are working upwards of 60 hours of overtime per pay period just to cover the minimum staffing ratios that we need. We are able to hire RNs. We are unable to retain them. And this is because of the long working hours, competitive wages. We are not offered continuing education. We are not offered hiring bonuses, such as other facilities in our area offer. Our nursing staff are burnt out, they're exhausted, and they cannot sustain this amount of overtime.
Thank you. Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself for the record and proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members. My name is Lynn Butcher. I'm a learning and development specialist at Minnesota Security Hospital, and I am testifying in place of Mike Moriarty. As I said, I'm a learning and development specialist. What that means is I help develop and provide training, particularly orientation training and continuing education. Due to severe lack of funding and severe lack of staffing, we are unable to maintain our training requirements. As you can imagine, we deal with patients who are very severe in the complexity of their cases. In order to work with those patients, our staff need to be trained. And to give you a little bit of context, prior to joining the state of Minnesota 9 years ago, I worked for a customer service company. We had 4 weeks of orientation. We had 4 weeks of orientation before people could take phone calls and answer emails about booking plane tickets. Our orientation to deal with the most severe and persistent mental illness in our state is 2 weeks. After 2 weeks, people are going out on the floor without competence, without confidence, and we can't get them back to continue their training. We've moved a significant portion of our training out of orientation to get people on the floor because we need bodies. And then we run a 60% no-show rate for continuing orientation, which we have coming back in the first year. 60% of the time, people cannot come because there is not coverage on the unit. After 4 o'clock, there is no clinical coverage. We say we're a treatment facility, and we do not provide treatment after 4 o'clock at night. And we don't because our clinicians are stretched. They would come in at night, but they also have to come in during the day. If we come in at night, then we can't come in during the day. It's that simple. There's not overtime for clinicians, and even if there were, we would be experiencing the same burnout rate that our direct care staff are. I see people come in excited. They want to work with this population. They understand the importance of working with this population. And in 6 months, they are burned out. They are leaving. They are ready to go. I ask that you please consider including the funding for our additional staffing in this bill. Thank you for allowing me to testify.
Thanks for your testimony. Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself and proceed.
Mr. Chair, members, my name is Scott Melby. I'm the program director at Minnesota Security Hospital. I've been working on the campus in St. Peter for 30 years. Over half of that time, I was a direct care staff. I'm here representing the collaborative process that we've engaged in. You've heard from some of our fellow staff. You've heard from some of our other union members that we've been working together on the proposal that the governor has presented that is currently not being considered. I want to take a moment and remind everyone here that Minnesota Security Hospital serves every single county in the state of Minnesota. We all work for you. We all take care of the most difficult psychiatric patients in the state of Minnesota. And part of that involves incidents that occur, and we do have staff that are injured in the line of duty. So we need the staffing proposal. We are asking for your support and investment for the state. If we don't get what we're asking for, if, for example, there's no additional funds for staffing, we are going to be faced with cutting at least 50 staff. You heard from some people that I work with already where even losing one position is devastating for us. We need the staffing proposal support that will improve safety for our staff. It'll ensure that we have the appropriate number of clinicians to treat this difficult patient population. We can have training for our staff. We'll be able to retain the skilled employees that we have so that we can keep our nurses and our clinicians with this difficult population. We need to be able to recruit qualified candidates. We need to be able to tell people that the state has invested in the work we do so they want to come work for us. And sadly, we need to support our staff that are injured in the line of duty. We need to take care of them when they're doing the work of the state of Minnesota. The governor's proposal needs your support. We need your support. We don't want more of the same. Thank you all for your time and consideration.
Thank you, Mr. Melby, for your testimony. Next up, we have Claire Sanford, Jessica Anderson, and Patrick Ness. And if I missed anybody from the security hospital, let me know. There was a kind of a big group that was in there, so if I missed somebody, please let us know. And that goes for the rest of the lineup. If you see that you weren't on or something, just let somebody know, so we don't want to make sure we skip over anybody.
Mr. Chair and members, I'm here speaking on behalf of Claire Sanford. My name is Chad Dunkley. I'm the CEO of New Horizon Academy. I'm also president of the Minnesota Child Care Association. The Minnesota Child Care Association represents about 250 child care centers throughout the state of Minnesota. Now, I want to say I'm sure that this committee nearly fell off their chairs when they saw the governor's proposal for child care assistance changes, and I wanted to share why. That is, there's two things. The federal government, after 30 years, finally revised their federal child care assistance law, and they substantially raised standards. It was led by Second District Congressman John Klein here in Minnesota as chair of the Education and the Workforce Committee. He made major changes. The new federal law says, number one, every program where federal funding is used has to be safe and has to be moving towards quality. Number two, we want more kids in poverty and high quality care. That, when you come back to Minnesota, has a huge fiscal cost, and I want to explain why. Number one, we have largely ignored child care assistance reimbursement rates since 2003. In 2003, we had a massive budget deficit. We stopped connecting child care assistance rates to the cost of care. And over 12 years, it gets lost in this budget and was largely ignored. And so even though you see these large costs about implementing the new federal regs and moving child care reimbursement rates, not to the federal recommended 75th percentile of market rates, but to the 50th percentile of market rates, these are federal requirements, and Minnesota won't meet federal minimums. And there are states like Idaho going to the 65th percentile of market rates. We do need to do this. But in addition to its federal regs, and it is expensive and it's long been ignored, when you look at the demographics of the program, 60% of the children on child care assistance are children of color. Every child on child care assistance is a child in poverty. This is a targeted program. It's the main targeted program for kids in poverty for early childhood, and we've been ignoring it, and it's time to fix it. So we do hope that we understand it's a large number, that you do consider that, because this child care assistance program is working, and we're losing thousands of providers in communities. This committee did consider nursing home rates last year. You will spend money when it's the right thing to do, and we understand that you do care about children or people who are vulnerable in their twilight years. But child care assistance is about caring about people that are vulnerable in their early years, and it's the right thing to do, and it will affect communities, and it will affect supply. So thank you very much.
Thank you for your testimony. Next up, we have Patrick Neff. Oh. I'm sorry. Welcome to the committee.
Oh, Jessica Anderson, was I also?
Oh, I'm sorry, Jessica. Yeah, okay. I thought he was in place of Jessica.
Well, you
sorry,
know,
welcome.
I second a lot of Chad's remarks, so I guess we could just consider those mine. Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I'm Jessica Anderson. I'm the Legislative Affairs Director for Children's Defense Fund Minnesota. Thank you for the opportunity to testify. My remarks also will focus on child care. We know that children need safe, consistent environments to thrive while their parents work to meet basic needs, and that when children grow up in families with sufficient financial resources and receive stable, nurturing care, they flourish from kindergarten to career. Child care strengthens our current workforce, future workforce, and secures the future prosperity of our state. We appreciate the work of the House this session to examine the issue of child care affordability and accessibility and the proposals that have been brought forward to improve components of the child care system. But we do hope to continue the conversation about making child care more affordable for families now and how the child care assistance program is an integral part of that solution and yet was not included in large part in this bill. So we at CDF, along with the Kids Can't Wait Coalition, of which we are a member, continue our call to fully fund CCAP so that all eligible families can access it, and then also increase provider reimbursement rates so that providers can afford to accept these families and families can find care that meets their needs. Until last year, when lawmakers appropriated enough money to fund CCAP program enrollment for an additional 350 families, state funding for basic sliding fee CCAP had decreased by 44% adjusted for inflation since 2003, and there are still 7,000 families on this wait list. Additionally, provider rates have eroded over the past decade. 10 years ago, 80% were covered in full by the CCAP reimbursement, and today it's just one-third. So in conclusion, with a tightening labor market, child poverty on the rise, and persistent racial disparities, it's more important now than ever to make sure that Minnesotans can afford child care. We believe that CCAP is a vital resource for low-income working parents of today and is a building block for children in the workforce of tomorrow. Thank you for your time and for your work.
Thanks for your testimony. Welcome to the committee.
Mr. Chair and members, my name is Patrick Ness, Public Policy Director at the Wilder Foundation. In the interest of ensuring everyone can go home tonight, I'll be brief. Thank you for including the Certified Community Behavioral Health Clinics in your bill. It's a big deal. We are excited. Thank you.
Thank you. Ben Gustafson. Welcome to the committee. We have Claire Wilson on deck, and I'm going to officially call the meeting to order. We now have a quorum. So welcome to the committee.
Chair, members of the committee, my name is Ben Gustafson. I'm a staff member at Fraser.
Frazier is a nonprofit that serves more than 9,600 children and adults who have autism, mental health, and other disabilities. I want to thank the committee for your leadership on the Best Life Alliance proposal this session. I know the committee is working hard to address the workforce crisis in home and community-based services, and we are hopeful that the legislature and governor can agree to a meaningful increase this year. Second, thank you for working on the spousal impoverishment changes, which have arisen as a result of CMS requirements. I also know the committee is deeply interested in providing relief for those individuals with disabilities who are impacted by the spend-down inequities for MA eligibility. Also, thank you for your continued work on these issues that directly impact individuals' opportunities to live as independently and integrated as they would like. Finally, thank you for supporting certified community behavioral health clinics. Your investment will help build an exciting new mental health model with greater coordination of care. Thank you.
Thanks for your testimony. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Claire Wilson. I'm the Executive Director of the Minnesota Association of Community Mental Health Programs and another designated cheerleader for the CCBHCs. And I just want to thank you again for your inclusion of the CCBHCs in the bill. I apologize. While I am not directly responsible for, I know we are contributing to the acronym situation we have going on in this state. But I will say that since the passage of the Excellence in Mental Health Act in 2014, which established the CCBH demonstration project, a broad coalition has come together to work towards implementation. And as you know, we're on a very aggressive timeline established at the federal level. And so passage this year is required for us to continue to move towards certification. I also really want to thank Representative Keel, who helped steward this through the House and who has been a true supporter of our chemical and mental health care access in Minnesota and particularly in rural Minnesota. We do have clinics moving towards certification right now, and I just wanted to update you on that. We have cities and the surrounding counties of Brainerd, Duluth, Crookston, Rochester, and the metro area. So establishing these coordinated services and funding these clinics will bring Minnesota closer to fully funded and elegantly designed mental health system. It's not the last step, it's an important step. I also encourage the committee to consider other initiatives included in the governor's budget, which would also strengthen the continuum of care, including fully staffing our direct care and treatment facilities, looking at expanding the transitions to community initiatives, and also the community-based competency restoration. So thank you again for the inclusion of CCBHCs in Health File 3467 and your continued commitment to maintaining Minnesota as a leader in mental health care, and we look forward to working with you and continuing the conversation.
Thank you for your testimony. We have Brian Lake, Kurt Rutson, and Steve Larson. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Brian Lake, I have a solo practice law firm, and I represent the State Bar Association. The bar works very closely with a large group of stakeholders on a pair of child support-related bills that were carried by Representative Norton and are included in your bill. The first sets up a task force to deal with child support matters, and the second makes some modifications to the parenting expense adjustment, which we think will be really critical to reducing conflict in family court. And I want to thank Representative Norton for her leadership on these issues, as well as Representatives Mahoney, Scott, and Lane for their support and their efforts on this. And thank you, Mr. Chair, again, for including them in the bill.
Thanks for your testimony today. Mr. Rutson, Mr. Larson, welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself and proceed.
Thank you, Chair, and the committee members. My name is Kurt Rutson with the ARC of Minnesota. I want to thank you for your time today for hearing me about the 5% increase on caregivers, and I want to thank you for that immensely, because we are in a crisis, I mean, on this issue, and we really need that, and we need more, but this will help us as we start to build of the wage that they should be getting to keep these very, very, very important people. Just to share with you, like I always say, folks, I mean, like it or not, to keep these people, to stay at these jobs and to help our most vulnerable, like it or not, these people do some pretty intimate personal things with them, like bathing, dressing, and you name it. And if we're changing every other month, that goes to more cost and more spending on these care professionals. And if it was me that every other month some person knew were coming in, I'd be scared to death. And all I'm asking is put yourselves in that situation and really think about this as you decide. And again, I thank you for your time.
Thanks for your testimony, Mr. Rutson. We appreciate it. Mr. Larson, welcome to the committee.
Mr. Chair and committee members, just to add a few comments to what Mr. Rutson had to say, we want to urge you to include in the HHS bill House File 1640 that was amended last night to provide a dedicated fund for a 5% increase over this next year. As Mr. Rutson and others have said, we have a workforce crisis, and we want to thank you for listening on behalf of the Best Life Alliance to your constituents from across the state who have been articulating the urgency of this particular problem. In Minnesota, we have 99,000 caregivers, 108,000 individuals with disabilities and older adults receiving services, and 8,700 vacancies. We do have a workforce crisis. Last week at the ARCS Day at the Capitol, Brenda Schultz from Worthington, who's a supervisor of a group home there, shared that in the previous two-week period, she had worked 150 hours. They have several vacancies in that particular position, and they simply can't fill those. We do have a workforce crisis. I want to invite all of you to join us for our next rally on the State Office Building steps next Tuesday, April 19th at 11 a.m., and the theme of the rally is 5% Can't Wait. I look forward to working with you and the Best Life Alliance agenda, not only this year and in future years, and thank you for your leadership on this issue.
Thank you, Mr. Larson. Mr. Rutson, we appreciate you being here. Next up, we have Mary Krinke, and followed by the Mille Lacs Band of Ojibwe, and then Stephanie Gill. Welcome to the committee, Ms. Krinke.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And for the record, my name is Mary Krinke, and I'm with the Minnesota Hospital Association. I have just four quick points that I'd like to make regarding this bill. I kind of want to join the choir and say that the Minnesota Hospital Association is very grateful that the Excellence in Mental Health Act was included in this bill, and thank Representative Keel for her work on this as well. I hope the committee understands that the ability to combine both mental health treatment and chemical addiction services that are so often comorbidities together, and being able to have both of those services sort of at one stop will not only improve access, but will improve the quality of the care that is delivered. It's very important that this appropriation happens this year in order to be considered for the National Demonstration Project. So thank you for making that a priority. The second thing I'd like to thank the chair and the committee for is not including something that was in the governor's budget. The governor's budget shifted a portion of the Medicaid funding to be paid for out of the Health Care Access Fund. And if you look at the latest Health Care Access Fund sheet, it is approximately $239 million of Medicaid expenses that the governor is proposing to take as the funding source, the Health Care Access Fund. So the Hospital Association is grateful that that provision is not included in this bill. I would like to also draw your attention, number three, to an item on page 69 of the bill. This is reporting on healthcare costs and volume, and I just would seek clarification on a couple points here. We're hoping that the data source for this will be the health plans. Many providers have contracts in place that say we cannot disclose our payment rates from the health plans, that we would be in violation of our contracts. So we're hoping that if this moves forward, that the data source that would be looked to would be the health plans. We would also like to encourage that the word commercial be added, because if you look at average payments and you include Medicaid and Medicare, then everyone on a commercial plan would be above the average. So if you think about that, if Medicare and Medicaid pay providers at such a low rate, if you just did an overall average, it would not be very helpful to the consumer. So a consumer wants to go online and see where their commercial payment is. We'd like it to be a comparison of commercial payments. And the fourth point, lastly and quickly, is as this bill works its way forward, the Hospital Association is supportive of the behavioral health hospitals and competency restoration, as well as the funding for the Anoka Metro Regional Treatment Center, realizing that you have very difficult budget target. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Ms. Krenke. All right. Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself for the record.
Thank you. Good afternoon, Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Samuel Moose. I'm the Commissioner of Health and Human Services for the Mille Lacs Band of Ojibwe. I'm here today to speak briefly in support of the proposal to transfer operations of the CARE Brainerd program, or otherwise known as Four Winds, to a tribal provider. Four Winds is the only state-operated program that provides culturally relevant substance abuse treatment for American Indian people in the state. The Mille Lacs Band of Ojibwe is interested and excited about the possibility of taking over operations of this program. Tribes have a greater likelihood of hiring and retaining American Indian staff and more experiences with American Indian healing and recovery practices. The program would continue in the same facility, and the band would lease the space from the state. This proposal includes a request for appropriations for transitioning the program, some physical plant renovations, and a subsidy grant that would cover the operations losses in fiscal years 2018 and 19. A bipartisan bill for this appropriation has been introduced to the House, House File 3777, and has support. I appreciate the opportunity to speaking with the committee on this proposal, and we'll try to answer any questions that the committee may have.
Thank you for your testimony, Mr. Moose. We do appreciate it. All right. Ms. Gill. Next up, we have Tim Walsh. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Tim Walsh. I'm a vice president with Minnesota Adult and Teen Challenge, also representing MARCH and the Minnesota Association of Treatment Directors. I want to thank you for inclusion of House File 3026, Representative Baker's bill, which addresses the IMD issue. And what this does is it maintains and ensures access and public funding for Minnesotans who require a residential level of care for chemical dependency and co-occurring treatment. And I just want to add that it serves about approximately 25,000 Minnesotans per year. So once again, I want to thank you, Mr. Chair, and members of the committee.
Thank you for your testimony. All right. We have, last up, we have Mr. Craig Nelson. And Mr. Nelson is our last testifier, so if there's anybody else who would like to testify, just flag down the page who's waving, and we can certainly accommodate you. We are moving very quickly, so we do appreciate that. Welcome to the committee, Mr. Nelson. Please introduce yourself for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you. My name is Craig Nelson. I am the interim president of LRN Associates Management Services, which owns the ICF DD in Murray County, about which there will be an amendment that you'll vote on tomorrow. I've come 500 miles for this testimony because the ICF DD in question is hanging by a thread, and unless there is some intervention financially, it could go under. So it's dire. Let me explain the background and my connection to it first. By the way, this ICF has a name which I'll refer to throughout, Prairie View. Prairie View was founded by my brother, Lewis, in 1985. And this is his company. LRN are his initials. He's in very ill health. And in the fall, he asked me to take a look at his business. I come here once a week. Once a month. I stay for 7 days to run his business. Then I return to my home, which is Chicago, to take care of my other work. I do this as an act of love for my brother. I receive no compensation whatsoever. I made my first trip to Prairie View in August. I got to know the staff and the community. And as I did, the motivations for my work broadened much farther beyond Prairie View to the Prairie View whole community. Before August of 2015, I knew nothing whatsoever about this industry. My background as a management consultant to heavy industry is as far from the care for the intellectually disabled as one could imagine. For I've never seen such dedication so modestly rewarded. I have to admit that until August, I'd never set foot in Slayton. So it's important to set the stage just a bit. It's all building and important, and I'm sorry you're strumming your fingers, but it's the background to what's happened to this facility. Prairie View is located in Slayton with a population of 2,100 in Murray County in the southwest region of the state. Slayton is the county seat. It has several other small towns reporting to it. It's about equidistant to two other county seats, Marshall in the north and Worthington in the south. Population there has declined about one-third to 8,500 since 1970. An interesting artifact. At Curry, one of the towns in Murray County, there's a piece of railroad Americana. There used to be a line that went there from the main line. It was abandoned in 1980. And when that happened, the population went into a free fall. Declined 45% over the next two decades. And I bring it up because, as you know, sometimes the impact of a decision has much farther reaching implications than the dollars and cents which originally thought to be the most important criteria. I mentioned earlier the population of Murray County has declined since 1970. One reason for that is that life is hard in Murray County. Only 11% of the population have a college degree, bachelor's or master's, compared to 50% in Hennepin and Ramsey County. The average weekly wages in Murray County are $602, half the wages of Hennepin and Ramsey County. But most households have two and three wage earners, so household income is about 77% of that of the Twin Cities, and yet, for all their sacrifice, they have less than 70% of the wealth that someone in the Twin Cities has. Why is that? Because the costs are higher for such essentials as food, fuel, heat, and car maintenance. That means that they have to be much more self-denying and frugal than in the Twin Cities, consuming on a per capita basis about 35% of the state average spending on vehicles and leisure goods. And to put Murray County in relief to its surrounding counties, its average weekly wage rate at $602 is second to the bottom, which is Lincoln, and that's only $5 below it. The ranking goes from the state average of $965 down to Lyon, which is $725, then in order, Nobles, Cottonwood, Redwood, Pipestone, and finally Murray. As a result of the low wages in Murray County, everyone works long hours and goes after every opportunity to increase the take-home pay. According to the Bureau of Labor Statistics, adjusted for seasonality, unemployment in Murray County is the lowest it's been in 5 years, between 2.1 and 2.9%. This is due in part to a net increase in the number of jobs in the service sector. It's also due to a net workforce reduction, a migration that occurred between 2010 and 2015. 1,000 workers left the county, and coincidentally, 1,000 workers increased in Lyon County, 30 miles away. While low unemployment is good for workers, makes it difficult for employers. This is especially true in Slayton. And looking at Slayton, one is struck by its relative isolation. And that topographical and geographical situation determines much regarding its economics. The four factors that affect its total cost: labor is in short supply, the net increase in jobs. Murray County and Slayton specifically have extreme unemployment volatility, and then there's the weather. The weather is a big factor, and that's why I mentioned the topography. Out on the prairie, if you've been there in the winter, the wind, the flat, all lead to one thing: drifting snow. It's a winding road between Marshall, 30 miles to the north, where there's a lot of workforce, and Slayton. In February this year, Slayton was cut off in three directions by the snow. Literally, you were alone. That kind of ordeal that happens every winter bars many from ever taking a job in Slayton. So here we are in Slayton with a shortage of labor, isolated by the weather, from getting workers from other towns, which causes labor costs to be bid up at a high rate year over year. This is Slayton's uniqueness. So now, with that as the background, I want to direct your attention to a few of the pages of that handout, if I could. First of all, page 3, the objectives. I'm here to answer two questions. What's unique about Slayton, and which I think I just nailed for you, and the second is, why now? Why? Why are we asking for something at this point? First of all, Prairie View, page 7. This is what it is. There's a small snapshot picture of it. An ICFDD, it was originally certified for 18 beds. ID certified 4 of those beds last fall because we had vacancies that were unfilled. Current occupancy is 12. The next several bullet points all attest to its quality, including discrepancy-free audits by state and federal auditors consecutively, years running. Also, the fact that the parents and guardians of each of these individuals have stayed with us since its inception in many cases, every year being offered alternatives, every year choosing to re-elect to stay at Prairie View. Because, of course, the most important measure of quality is the thriving of the consumers. Page 12. So what we have and what we're facing and with the direness is what we call the perfect storm. A dramatically rising costs fueled by scarcity-driven direct care costs and sudden, sharply declining billable days. So that means that the rate per billable day has got to keep pace with the rising cost for billable day. The modest increases in per diem, which have been approximately 1.8% over the past 5 years, have not kept pace with the rise even in the direct labor cost. But let's begin with where we are in terms of the per diem. Page 13. So it's a benchmark of our rate against the other rates in the state. And you see Prairie View at the bottom, 188.21, with a scale up to 428. As I understand it, the rate structure reflects the geographic differences in what was perceived to be economic cost of different regions.
Mr. Nelson, you are at about 10 minutes right now. If you could try and condensing,
all right,
please.
I'll wrap it up in 1 minute.
Thank you.
So we have, and you'll see on page 17, if you will, that's this chart that's rather busy. We're opening up everything to you. That's our complete cost structure. and it shows that 62% of our cost is direct labor cost. The same direct labor that's bid up by those factors that I mentioned before. And page 19 shows that the growth, this one, the growth in the direct labor over the past 5 years has been 35% versus the growth in the per diem, which has been about 1.8% a year, a grand total of 6.8%. And the result is this curve. The curve that projects forward the gap, which is growing. The top line is the cost. The bottom line is the revenue per billable day. And that shaded area is how much loss is projected just for the next year. $700,000, which, because, of course, we're a small family business, is untenable. With that, I urge you to pass this amendment. Without it, we may have to close. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Nelson, for your testimony today and for making the 500-mile trip to come and be with us while we're here today.
My pleasure.
Representative Leland.
Mr. Nelson, I also want to thank you for coming and making a very compelling argument, and also wishing the best to your brother that he will recover from his illness.
Okay. Welcome to the committee. If you could please introduce yourself.
Eric Nelson with LRN Associates Management Services, Inc. My dad opened the business. My mother passed away a year ago, and I am kind of, along with my uncle, doing a lot of the work. So I get to see firsthand our staff. And I live in Marshall. It's pretty close to Slayton. And, I'm just going to speak from the heart, because I didn't write everything down like my uncle with charts and graphs. But
and briefly, if you could, please.
Okay, yeah, I'm sure people are getting hungry, and we want to get out of here, too. So if you could just take into account the amendment, the staff we're having a labor shortage, and at the same time they're asking for raises. This week we just made payroll, and that's not paying me. I didn't get paid, so it doesn't matter what about me, but you're only as good as your staff. So if you could please just think about our amendment. Thank you.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Nelson. Next up, we have Ms. Braze. If you could please introduce yourself for the committee and give us your testimony.
Yes, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Twyla Braze. I'm president of Citizens Council for Health Freedom. And I'm going to limit my comments to just a few things. And I wanted to be here last night just to support Representative Dean's bill to repeal Minsher. And so please let him know of that support. And we have a lot of problems with Minsher, including the cost of it, the lack of the enrollment at the level that it was supposed to be at. We're also pleased with the language that doesn't allow or controls the transfer of dollars. And in addition to that, I'd like to say that we are pleased as well with the fact that there will be a strong notice, or a very prominent notice, regarding if you choose to go on to Medicaid, that you will know about your estate and a lien on your estate. That should be front and center. We'd prefer it to be right smack dab on the website so that you couldn't pass that page without agreeing to that if this part of the bill on Minsher doesn't succeed and we still have it after this session is over. And then the last thing is on page 69-11, the reporting on healthcare costs and volume. I'm not sure exactly where this language came from, and our concern just about this is that we're wondering about the possibility of, as we move towards more and more reporting of prices, whether or not we also move towards the possibility of price fixing in the future, whereas our organization dealing with freedom would really like to have competition with healthcare costs and let individuals compete rather than spend their time reporting prices. So that's the only comments that I have, Mr. Chair, and thank you very much.
Thank you, Ms. Braze, for your testimony. Next, we have Rochelle Westland from the counties. If you could please come forward. All right, welcome to the committee. If you could please introduce yourself and give us your testimony.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, ladies and gentlemen of the committee. My name is Rochelle Westland. I'm the Health and Human Services Policy Analyst for the Association of Minnesota Counties. I'm here today representing AMC, the Minnesota Association of County Social Service Administrators, MACSA, the Minnesota Inter-County Association, MICA, and the Local Public Health Association, or LPHA. Thank you for the opportunity to discuss the proposed health and human services provisions in the health supplemental budget. Counties understand there are limited funds available, and with a zero target, there's not much room for investment into health and human services delivery systems. However, counties also recognize that there remains a great need in Minnesota, especially for Minnesota's most vulnerable children. As we move toward conference committee, we hope to see further investment in the child protection system, specifically in the areas of child care, foster care, and in prevention efforts like targeted home visiting. These continue to be areas of great need throughout the state and will remain areas of county concern as we work to ensure the safety of Minnesota's children. We are concerned with one provision that appears to be redirecting funds for child protection, which counties are already struggling with, to implement the recommendations of the Child Protection Task Force. We do appreciate the proposed budget does not appear to shift significant costs to counties, specifically in the classification of IMDs as CD facilities in order to receive federal funding and the federal pilot for certified community behavioral health centers. We also would like to thank you for not including county cost shifts that are in the governor's proposed budget, which increase county cost shares for individuals provisionally discharged from MSOP and the cost shift for community behavioral health hospitals. This would have significant impact on county budgets that will force many counties to increase their property tax levies. Counties recognize this committee's commitment to working with counties to lessen the workloads placed on counties by improving our IT systems. Counties remain concerned, however, about the workload that periodic data matching will impose on county staff, and as we move toward conversion, we are also concerned about the proposed asset limits that are being applied to public programs, undoing the bipartisan work of administrative simplification as we seek to automate our outdated eligibility systems. As such, we support continued funding for technology systems to help counties efficiently perform our duties. We look forward to continued work with you as we move forward, and thank you again for your time.
Thank you, Ms. Westland, for your testimony. Next, we have Eric Nelson. And Eric is not here, so we have Ethan Vogel. I mean, if you could please come forward, give us your testimony, and proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members. My name is Ethan Vogel. I'm a legislative representative with AFSCME Council 5. I apologize to the chair and the committee staff for not getting my name on the testifying list ahead of time, and I promise I will make this very brief. I understand you heard from one of our members from St. Peter. I just wanted to get AFSCME Council 5's concerns on the record when it comes to the lack of additional funding for Anoka Metro Regional Treatment Center, as well as St. Peter, among other things. You know, we feel we've done a pretty good job documenting to you the need for additional funding at Anoka and at St. Peter, and so to see a zero increase is very troubling. So we just hope that as this moves forward in the process, you consider those needs. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Is there anyone else who wishes to testify on the bill? Seeing no one moving forward then. Tomorrow, we'll be starting at 10:30 a.m. and going through the markup of the bill. An email was sent out, and actually it will be sent out, excuse me, when all the amendments are posted. Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have a question really for Chair Dean, or just on the procedures here, or maybe Holly can whisper in your ear if she has the answer there. But I'm just wondering whether we can expect a substantive author's amendment, and if there is one, whether the 24-hour rule would be waived for amendments to that, to to whatever is offered as the substantive author's amendment. Can anyone answer that?
I think the amendments, you'll have a very good idea of what's going to be in the bill within the amendments. There's not a great deal of surprise that you'll have tomorrow, Representative Liebling. And as I said, there's still opportunity to offer amendments today through 5 o'clock, 5:30.
Well, Mr. Chair.
Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, I'm still a little confused, Representative Dean. I mean, when you say things, we won't be surprised. I mean, there are things that we heard that are not in the bill now. And, if we're kind of, I don't know if you're sort of telling us we should assume that anything we heard might be in there, if we want to amend something that we heard that might go in, or if you're going to give us some time if it does go. I mean, I don't want to waste staff time drafting amendments for things that won't be in the bill. Or, you know, we won't know exactly what language you might offer to the bill and so on. So, I don't know, that leaves us all a little bit hanging. Or maybe I'm not understanding exactly what you mean. I know we've got until, 5 o'clock today, but if we don't know what you might be putting in there that's substantive, I don't know how we can really meet that deadline.
Chair Dean.
Mr. Chair and Representative Liebling, you know, the bill is before you. The amendment, the opportunity to post amendments will go through 5 o'clock at the end of the day, and that's what we'll follow. I think if you look at the, there's already, I think there folks on your side of the aisle are working on amendments, are already posted them for different caucus priorities. We understand that, want to be able to accommodate that. But the general contours of the spreadsheet and the bill are fairly well in order. So I think that you can get a very good idea by looking at the combination.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chair.
Any other questions from members? All right, the meeting is adjourned.